Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Monday, June 12, 2023. The International Committee of the Red Cross says getting information from Sudan is becoming difficult.
What we're seeing, unfortunately, in Khartoum, but also in other places affected by the conflict, like Darfur, is that the fighting is ongoing. And this exacerbates the already dire humanitarian situation for Sudanese civilians.
And the former Archbishop of the internal province of Jonglei wants peace.
I've been praying for him, and he has written this, and I'm looking forward to meet him coming to us so that we can revoke the defrocking.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The spokesperson of the International Committee of the Red Cross says humanitarian conditions across some parts of Sudan, including the western region of Darfur, are dire. Alyona Sienko says telecommunication glitches coupled with the ongoing fighting between the Rapid Support Forces and the Sudan Armed Forces has prevented aid workers from getting accurate information about humanitarian situation across the country.
What we're seeing, unfortunately, in Khartoum, but also in other places affected by the conflict, like Darfur, is that the fighting is ongoing. And this exacerbates the already dire humanitarian situation for Sudanese civilians, because now they have been facing almost 2 months of uninterrupted fighting with very little respite. And that, unfortunately, just makes the same humanitarian problems that they were already facing just making them worse.
Let's talk about Khartoum, Omdurman and Bahri. A lot of Sudanese activists and people speaking from Khartoum were raising concerns about dead bodies left on the streets. Is ICRC involved in that process?
Dead bodies lying in the streets, it is indeed a large problem. And we should not forget also that some of these bodies are in very difficult to reach places. And now that we are starting the rainy season, the rains are risking to just exacerbate the problem. We are working with the Sudanese Red Crescent Society, and their volunteers have been doing considerable and very important work in this regard, collecting the dead bodies, but not just collecting, but also identifying them, because we must not forget that we are not talking about just bodies. These are people, and they must not only be collected, but also properly identified, so that the families who are looking for their loved ones, they can get the answers. So we have been supporting our partners from the Sudanese Red Crescent Society, providing them with the personal protective equipment, things like gloves, like masks and body bags, and they were trying to collect as many as possible, but also adapting to the extremely challenging security situation.
Regarding this situation, where you are working with your local partners to resolve some of these difficult challenges, is there any dead toll that is out there, or the bodies that have been collected so far from the streets of Khartoum?
I don't have the most updated figure on me that I can share. I think they have collected more than 100. And unfortunately, also getting the most up-to-date information from our colleagues is complicated by the difficulties of communication, because the telecommunication networks are down in many parts of the country.
What is happening in Darfur, Western Darfur specifically? What are your partners in Darfur telling you?
The situation in Darfur, in Western Darfur, but also in other parts of Darfur, is extremely difficult. And again, for us, getting in touch with our colleagues in Darfur has been a huge challenge. And also we just worry for them and for their security. And when we do manage to get in touch with them, unfortunately, the accounts are extremely worrying because, yes, the fighting is ongoing. People are fleeing. There are shortages of food, of water. We hear that some families only have mango fruit as the only food that is available to them. And one of the biggest concerns for us is the healthcare.
Talking about humanitarian operations within the twin cities of Khartoum, who gives consent or permission to aid agencies to say to move from point A to point B?
Well, for us to be able to operate safely, we are in touch with both parties to the conflict. And we can move when we obtain security guarantees from both of them, because there are important priorities, but also we need to make sure that we can deliver assistance without compromising the security of our own staff.
You talked about the health issues or health conditions of people in Darfur and other parts of Sudan. There were reports of hospitals in Khartoum running out of supplies. Talk to us about that situation.
Many hospitals have stopped working. We are now estimating that only 20% of hospitals in Khartoum are still operational. And so it is an urgent priority to support the hospitals that are still working. So the Sudanese healthcare workers, the doctors and nurses, they have been working in extremely difficult conditions, without running water, without electricity, and running low on medical supplies. So we have been coordinating and working with the Ministry of Health to deliver supplies, surgical supplies to these hospitals. And we have managed to reach 10 hospitals in Khartoum and the outskirts. And of course, this is very small compared to the massive needs, and more needs to be done. But also for us to be able to put in place such a large-scale humanitarian operation, we need a pause in fighting and we need security for our teams.
That's Alianu Sienko, spokesperson of the International Committee of the Red Cross. She spoke with me earlier today from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Still on Sudan, a civil society activist says civilians in many parts of Darfur region, including the El Jineina and the capital of West Darfur state, are facing dire humanitarian conditions. One local aid worker says civilians have no access to basic services following recent attacks by armed men. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Juba.
Asad Atahir, a manager of a local non-profit community empowerment for development, says he's worried about the fate of families who need humanitarian support in parts of Darfur. Atahir told VOA from Niala town of South Darfur state early today that many markets have run out of food supplies. He says prices of available food and medicines have skyrocketed.
The humanitarian situation in El Jineina is dire due to heavy violence that engulfed the area into tribal conflict among different communities. The fighting led to the closure of all the health facilities in the town, and according to eyewitnesses, dozens of people have died due to lack of medical services.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or UN OCHA, released a report last week saying the humanitarian situation in Darfur is dire. Atahir says due to intense fighting in some part of Darfur, people are facing difficulties in accessing services.
Local population are unable to access basic needs amidst skyrocketing of prices due to breakdown of the bank system in the whole of Darfur. This has affected the livelihoods of the people who are in dire need for humanitarian aid.
Efforts to reach the WFP communication officer for Sudan, Lenny Kensley, for comment on this story were unsuccessful. UN OCHA says clashes between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces have continued for over 8 weeks, with fighting reported in Khartoum, El Obeid, and different parts of Darfur since mid-April. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
the United Nations mission in South Sudan and some internally displaced persons sheltering at a protection of civilians or POC site in Upper Nile State Capital Malakal say calm has returned to the camp following last week's ethnic clashes. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
The French medical charity Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, says 20 people were killed and 50 others injured when clashes broke out among the internally displaced persons sheltering at the UN-run protection of civilian site in Malaka last week. Some IDPs who were forced out by the violent clashes to take refuge in Malaka say some families who fled from the camp have returned. John Amom, who resides in one of the camps for IDPs in Malakal, say the humanitarian situation is dire following last week's incident.
We are in COC now. Situation is normal, no problem. Most of children and women are in compound, so they think about situation, what is happening that time.
Both Wing Diu, who fled from his camp last week, says the fighting has affected some IDPs who are seeking shelter in Malakal town.
People are staying in the church, and this is not enough for them. Some are staying outside of the church in the compound, and the rain is raining. This is a situation we have where there is no toilet, there is no water, where there is no shelter.
In a pre-recorded audio extended to this program earlier today, ANMIS spokesperson Linda Tom says ANMIS is working with other aid agencies to provide support to IDPs who fled from their camp.
The mission is facilitating the work of humanitarian workers who are providing emergency assistance, such as clean drinking water and non-food items to thousands of people displaced into Malakal town. It is also assisting with dignified funerals for those who have lost lives.
Tom says community leaders should address the causes of the conflict between the two communities residing at the POC in Malakal.
UNMIS expresses deep regret for the loss of life and offers condolences to the affected families in the Malakal UN Protection of Civilian Site. It urges community leaders to continue to cooperate with all stakeholders to address both the triggers and the root causes of this violence.
The ANMIS spokesperson says last week's fighting only stopped after government forces intervened. The ANMIS operates under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which enables Security Council to take forced action with respect to threats to the peace, breaches of the peace, and acts of aggression. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a former archbishop of the internal province of Jonglei changes his tone. Find out why after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is wealth an important factor when making marriage decisions?
Wealth is not an important factor when making marriage decisions, because most wealth is best acquired when you're together as a couple.
Of course, I think that any decision that involves another person, that's only fair to include wealth as an important thing. Like, I can live on almost no money, but I couldn't expect my wife or my children to.
Not wealth, but security, financial security. Because if you're planning to have kids, then you need to provide for them.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
Sudan, You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The former Archbishop of the Jonglei Internal Province of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan, Ruben Akurdit, has written a letter to the head of the Anglican Church in South Sudan asking for reconciliation. Akurdit was expelled from the Anglican Church in 2020 for allegedly going against church constitution. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Former Archbishop Akurdit confirmed to South Sudan in Focus that he sent a letter to Archbishop Justin Badi Arama, but he declined to discuss the matter further.
Yeah, I wrote it, but I have no comment now. I'm not ready for interview. I'm not ready for interview because it is in front of the planet. And what he said, I don't know. I cannot just talk about what I don't know what is going to be the outcome.
Speaking to VOA in an exclusive interview, Archbishop Justin Badi Arama says he welcomes Akurdit's new turn.
The church is a place of repentance and forgiveness. So I've been praying for him, and he has written this, and I'm looking forward to meet him coming to us so that we can revoke the defrocking and receive him into the dignity of the church.
Akurdit's latest move follows a reported mediation efforts led by the Minister of Presidential Affairs, Barnaba Marial Benjamin. A letter dated June 10th, signed by Marial, contained resolutions reached and passed during a mediation meeting between Akurdit and the office of the head of the Anglican Church in South Sudan. Arama added that the church decisions are guided by its constitution, traditions, and canon laws. He says the church is yet to decide on other resolutions once Akurdit is lifted off defrocking.
That was a meeting done outside the church. And then the result of that meeting is the apology letter, which has come to us in the church, and we accept it. We are ready to reinstate him if he comes, because a church is a center of repentance and forgiveness. So that one, we are ready for it. But anything circulating outside that is what we don't know yet. And anything resolved by the government or by the elders is also subject to be verified with the church constitution, church laws and canons, which we have not yet done those.
Akurdit was expelled by Archbishop Arama in August 2020 after he was charged for allegedly disobeying canonical laws, violation of the constitution, standing orders and laws of the church, as well as misleading and dividing Christians. A court ruling in Juba passed in December 2020 asked the church to hold the Akurdit's expulsion and the appointment of any successors pending final ruling. But Archbishop Arama rejected the ruling, saying the court decision was incorrect, adding that church administrative issues have nothing to do with courts. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Kampala, where Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni said Sunday evening he's still testing positive for COVID-19, so will remain in isolation. In a tweet, he said he rested well and indicated that he was feeling better. He urged Ugandans to get vaccinated against the virus. He initially tested positive on Wednesday. One of the world's longest serving leaders, Museveni has ruled the East African country since 1986. Once hailed as a reformist, he helped end years of tyranny under former leaders Idi Amin and Milton Obote. But the former rebel leader has since cracked down on dissent and changed the constitution to allow himself to contest elections again and again. At least 48 million children around the world are forced to work. The United Nations says 56% of all those in child labor live in middle-income countries, while an additional 2 million live in high-income countries. And as the international community marks the World Day Against Child Labor today, Monday, the UN says efforts to tackle child labor over the last three decades have demonstrated that the issue can be eliminated if the root causes are addressed. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
World Day Against Child Labour is observed on June 12th and is intended to serve as a mechanism for the growing worldwide movement against practice. This year, the International Labour Organization, ILO, is emphasizing the link between social justice and child labour. In a statement, the ILO Director General Gilbert Hubo calls on the international community to step up the fight against the practice.
What is happening with child labor is the very opposite of social justice. For the first time in 20 years, child labor is on the rise. 160 million children, almost 1 in 10 worldwide, are in child labor. And what is worst, half of them, 80 million, are in the most hazardous forms of child labor. That's work with a real threat to their physical and mental health.
According to the United Nations in Africa, more than 72 million children are working, making it the highest number ever globally. Other regions with the highest number of children in labor are Asia and the Pacific, which accounts for 7% of all children at work. Hubo says the practice can be eliminated in member states by supporting the fight for the rights of children.
But child labor rarely happens because parents are bad or do not care. No, rather, it is springing from a lack of social justice. The antidote to poverty-driven child labor is decent work for adults, so they can support their families and send their children to school, not to work.
The UN report indicates that Africa, Asia, and the Pacific regions account for almost 9 out of every 10 children engaged in child labor worldwide. As for the other regions, the Americas account for 11 million of children in child labor. Europe and Central Asia have 6 million, and the Arab states account for 1 million. Even though the percentage of children in child labor is highest in low-income countries, there are more in middle-income countries. That includes 9% of children in lower middle income countries who are working and the 7% of children in upper middle income countries. Reporting for VOA, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Sacramento, California.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
That's all we prepared for you this Monday. We now leave you with Sultan Clinton and the song Jamila. We have been listening to Sultan Clinton and the song Jamila. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. Don't forget to visit voafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you missed this program, go to www.voafrica.com/South Sudan. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Adrius Regis, we wish you good evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's no surprise that largely due to numerous armed conflicts, climate change, and increasingly violent weather events, people in many parts of the world are suffering from hunger and malnutrition, even starvation. Less obvious is another burgeoning crisis, child wasting and severe acute malnutrition. Child wasting, defined as low weight for height, is the most immediate, visible, and life-threatening form of malnutrition, according to UNICEF. Affecting around 13.6 million children, wasting causes the death of one out of every five kids under five, or about 1 million per year. Wasting is especially detrimental for children under the age of two. Indeed, it's important that the mother receives proper nutrition from the beginning of pregnancy and continues until after the child's second birthday. But if that child is severely undernourished, he or she must be treated with specialized foods, such as ready-to-use therapeutic foods. Last year, the United States, working through USAID, made the largest ever one-time contribution of $200 million to the purchase of ready-to-use therapeutic foods. The funding has had a tremendous impact, said USAID Administrator Samantha Power. USAID's contribution helped treat nearly two-thirds of wasting cases across 15 particular hotspot countries. The funding helped UNICEF reach 5.5 million children with life-saving treatment. Nonetheless, a growing slate of emergencies threatens to reverse that progress, said Administrator Power. One of the most pressing needs is a sustainable source of funding. Another is improving primary health care, and that means more health care workers. USAID's efforts training health workers in northern Ghana shows how effective primary care workers can be at addressing underlying risk factors for wasting, said Administrator Power. Still, primary health care is only part of the puzzle. It doesn't matter if a mom knows how to breastfeed her baby if she's not nourished enough to adequately nurse the baby. It doesn't matter if she knows which foods her toddlers need to grow if she's struggling to feed them anything at all. Without long-term efforts to curb the global food and nutrition crisis, previously treated children could return to poor diets and high risk of infections, where they could easily become malnourished once again. We need a sustainable strategy to fight child hunger, one that empowers countries to treat and prevent child wasting, said Administrator Power in a tweet. We must invest in tools that work, like ready-to-use therapeutic foods, and bolster primary care to build a resilient, hunger-free future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.